This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Write On, showcasing the work and lives of Otago and Southland writers. Tune in for news and interviews with your local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Kindly sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up. Good afternoon and welcome. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Vanda Simon, which is the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors, and it's sponsored by that great team at the University Bookshop. So join us for the next hour as we get to delve into the wonderful world of books.
Fiona Farrell is an award-winning writer of novels, poetry, short fiction, plays and non-fiction, including a number of works relating to the Christchurch earthquakes. Now, Fiona now calls Dunedin home and has recently released her latest novel, The Deck. Fiona, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Vanda.
I'm going to read the back cover blurb first, just to give our listeners out there a wee taste of what this novel is about. What is the point of inventing stories when reality eclipses imagination? A little way off in the future, during a time of plague and profound social collapse, a group of friends escapes to a house in the country where they entertain themselves by playing music, eating, drinking, and telling stories about their lives. There are tales of thieves and pirates, deaths and a surprise birth, a freak wave, and many other stories of misadventure resulting in unexpected felicity. The Deck borrows the motifs of Giovanni Boccaccio's 14th century masterpiece, The Decameron, in which another small group gathered to avoid contagion and pass the time telling stories. But what is the role of fiction, this novel asks, as civilization falters? Which sounds intriguing, and wasn't intriguing, I might add. I absolutely love this book. Now, you were living on Banks Peninsula when the Christchurch earthquake struck, and wrote works, both fiction and non-fiction, that reflected those events. And in The Deck, you visit characters' experiences in a time of plague, you know, written when we were experiencing a pandemic, a COVID pandemic. Why is writing fiction that reflects our reality important to you?
Well, yes. writing fiction rather than non-fiction, because with fiction you can you're really working with metaphor. You're not working with absolute fact, so you're a lot freer to follow ideas, create story, and see what it is that you really feel about something. You're not tied down to the realities, and that's what I love about fiction. That's why I think fiction can do something, can say something about an event that it's not really possible to say as clearly or as emphatically or with as much feeling as you can when you're writing fiction.
I guess you get to explore emotion so much more than you can when you are writing a non-fiction work.
Yes, I found myself saying in an earlier interview that when I'm writing nonfiction, when I get to the end of writing a nonfiction book, I know what I know. But when I get to the end of writing fiction, I know what I feel about something. So it's to do with feelings and emotions. It's to me, fiction is quite close to dreaming in a way. It has a kind of almost hallucinatory kind of quality, because you're really making up people that don't exist and having conversations with characters who don't exist. And there's something dreamlike about it. And just like a dream, I think a novel can sort out what you really feel about something.
It gives you great license to explore things in a way that's different.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know all about that as well, as a writer, as a novelist. Yes. It gives you enormous license.
So after a major disaster or traumatic event, I've heard other writers discuss how soon is too soon to include or talk about it in work. What did you take into consideration in writing about something with such clear parallels to the pandemic?
Well, what I did was actually set it in the future. It's not exactly the pandemic that we've just lived through. It's, do you mean talking about the deck rather than the books about the Christchurch?
Yes, talking about the deck, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I set it in the future deliberately, just a little bit in the future, again, so I wasn't tied down to the actualities of what happened under COVID. And what I did was invent a more lethal kind of pandemic, a much worse one, which has some of the qualities of Ebola. So it's a hemorrhagic virus that's spreading across the planet and causing massive death, even worse than COVID, something much more fearsome. Because in fiction, you're always working, you can work with greater extremes and you can imagine things. And so that freed me from actually sticking to what happened in 2020, 21, 2022. I was freed from all that and I didn't get caught up in the fiction and the politics of what happened here during the COVID pandemic.
Which I suppose is great in a way because that therefore you could concentrate on the realities of the characters.
Yes.
Survival, getting away.
Yes. And also just the way some of the lovely qualities about humans when they're in extreme situations. Because these ones, the characters on the deck aren't just facing pandemic. There's also the reality of a country which has become drought-ridden and they've escaped the one little green patch, one of the few that's left in the country. And there's species extinction. They're coping with a whole lot of things which are, in fact, things that are current, but I've pushed it a little bit further into the future. And it's become more extreme and more pronounced. But what happens is that what fascinates me is the way that people respond to extreme events. That's what interested me in the quakes in Christchurch, both in the fiction and in the non-fiction work that I wrote about that people react in really remarkable ways and often with great love and nobility. And I find the beauty of that human response when we're up against it really fascinating. And that's what I wanted to write about in this book as well. It's just a group of people who are in an extreme situation, but they are continuing to behave the way humans behave. They're falling in love with each other. They reveal things that had happened to them that they should have told someone years before. They entertain each other. And that's the sort of thing that I find interesting, the way humans continue to be humans, even in really extreme situations.
Now, I loved the structure of this novel, you know, starting with the frame, which was like a non-fictional chapter, and then the novel itself, and then finishing with the author's conclusion. So sort of alluded earlier, but describe how the structure came about and was revealed as a great thing to do for you for this book.
Well, that's something that I pinched, really. That's what I borrowed from Boccaccio. His book, which was written in about 1351, a few years after the great bubonic plague outbreak in Florence in 1348, 1349, which killed, they think, about 80% of the population. It killed millions and millions of people across Europe. And he was someone who'd been caught up in that in Florence. He's a Florentine scholar. someone whose family were affected. The woman that he was in love with was died. They died very quickly and very horribly. But he settled down a little bit after the pandemic, the bubonic plague pandemic, and he began writing a book. And he wrote it not in Latin, he wrote it in Italian, he wrote it in his own language, whereas normally he wrote in Latin. But he structured the book in a really interesting way. He, first of all, wrote a very, very brief introduction, the prologue. The Italians call it la cornice, the frame, because it's the sort of frame, the dark frame that surrounds all the stories he's telling. And the frame is his account of what happened in Florence when the plague struck. And it's truly horrifying, really, really terrible, what happens when a virus or a bacteria runs amok and there's no controls and there's no 1 p.m. press briefings and there's no vaccinations or whatever. Just a horrific account of the entire city dissolving into anarchy and chaos and bodies piling up in the streets and pigs eating them and people becoming utterly anarchic and reckless, and people in the country, the farmers, just letting all their animals out and then curling up to die in their houses. I mean, it's a truly horrific account. And then he starts writing fiction. And the fictions he writes are stories told by 10 characters who decide to leave the city because the plague is running rampant there. They decide to make an escape to a villa that one of them owns. And they're all young and they're all beautiful. They're between 18 and 28 years old. And there's 7 women and 3 men. They're all friends and relations. And they retreat to this country villa. And then it's high summer. Every afternoon, they dine well, because they're Italians, dine on dainties, and they drink delicious wine, and they play music, and they dance, and they sing. And they also nominate one of them each day for 10 days to be the king or queen of that day. And they are able to choose a topic, and everybody in the group has to tell a story relating to that topic. And so there's 10 stories every day about different topics. And at the end of the time, they return to Florence and there are 100 stories. And then Boccaccio finishes it with another bit of the frame, which is about his role as a writer, his role as an author. And he defends himself because some of the stories are pretty raunchy. In fact, one of them is so raunchy that English translators haven't translated one whole story since about the 18th century. It's always been left in the Italian because it's so, they thought it was so rude. So it's about like a very, very grubby old hermit and a very naive young nun. Anyway, we'll leave it there. But they didn't bother to translate it. So he defends himself against charges of being too raunchy and too lightweight. And he says, well, that's who I am. He says, I'm as light as a bubble. And he just defends himself. And in that final little bit of the frame, he talks about his role as a writer. And so that's what I borrowed. I borrowed the prologue, which was about the pandemic, the actual pandemic, the COVID in New Zealand, which was the frame in which I was writing in 2022. And then I told the stories, the fiction, and then I had the rest of the frame at the end, which is about the role of fiction and writing. So it's a long answer, sorry. But
no, it's lovely. It must have been such a apart from the rather awful sounding descriptions of the plague times, it must have been quite a delight to discover something like that.
Yes. Well, it's often painted, there are often paintings of this event, of these stories. They're very, it's a very lyrical, beautiful fiction that he writes. in this lovely image of these young people dancing and enjoying themselves, and in the background there's this horrific thing happening. It's just, it really is really poignant and wonderful.
To me, the characters in the deck really reminded me of that, you know, that settling around the campfire to tell your stories, you know, especially with your gorgeous subheadings. I'm just going to read to people one of the subheadings because I loved them. The Deer Hunters, the Sorceress and the Muddy Boot, a second tale of one who, after diverse misadventures, attains unexpected felicity. How important do you think storytelling is to people just to process or deal with life in such uncertain situations?
Well, I think it's vital as part of our coping mechanism. I think right now we're living in an era which doesn't look too good at the moment. The outcomes don't look too good. I think we're down to 450 elephants. Is that right? Something like that. Polar bears are almost extinct. Vast numbers of extinctions. I mean, there are extinctions every day that just happen on a regular basis. We're very systematically destroying our planet and destroying ourselves. And I have children, I have grandchildren, and if I let myself look over that particular precipice, I can get very perturbed indeed and bothered about what's it going to be like for my kids when they're my age. I'm 75. What's it going to be like for my daughters when they're 75? What's it going to be like for my granddaughters, because I have four granddaughters? We only do girls in my family. But what's it going to be like for them when they're 75? And I think when you consider that and come up against the reality of it, it's a pretty horrifying vision, really, of how the future is shaping up to be. All the signposts are looking pretty dire, and yet we've got to retain some kind of optimism and some kind of hope. That's absolutely essential. And moreover, we've got to do something. We've got to act to try and avert this. And fiction is one way I think we can say, look, being a human is a fantastic privilege and wonder to be alive on this planet. And we should, we need to tell stories to comfort ourselves, but we also need to tell stories that make us value who we are and what the planet is and our place here. I think storytelling is a fundamental human capacity, and it's one of the great things that we have at our command, is this ability to imagine a future, imagine a situation, and try and work our way through it that way. And then make a plan and act. I think storytelling is fundamental.
And fundamental to storytelling, of course, is your cast of characters. And I loved in this book that they were so beautifully interconnected, as is revealed along the path and the journey of the book. So how did these characters come to you, make their presence felt?
Well, it's a funny thing, isn't it? I mean, you know as well as I do, you're not quite sure where they come from, but they take on as great a reality as people who are living and breathing. They become very present in your life while you are imagining them. They are just paper dolls. They're not real, but they take on a sort of reality. As I was writing, they became more and more solid. They take on greater shape. As I wrote dialogue for them, I began to hear their voices. As they behaved, as I found myself, I constantly surprise myself when I'm writing. I don't make any plan. I don't have any plan at all when I start. I have no idea where I'm going with a book or with characters. I just sit down in the morning and see what's going to happen. It's a very time-consuming, laborious way of writing, but I don't have any plan at all. I don't even know what I'm going to write about when I start out. And it slowly reveals itself to me, and it becomes more and more clear as I do one draft after another. I do about four drafts usually, and lots of rewriting in between. So they become apparent bit by bit. Yeah.
And this group weren't all just young people aged between 20 and 25.
No, these people aren't young. They're old. They're my generation mostly, not all of them, but they are, for the most part, people who are sort of in their 60s, 70s. And I did that because I think they have – my generation, I think, always have such marvellous backstories. I mean, anyone who lives a long time gets a few thumps and bumps along the way, and they become increasingly interesting and complicated, yet fundamentally always themselves. If you've known someone for a very long time, as one does, and you can still remember with old friends what they were like when they were 15, and although they might change a bit and they might look different, there's a sort of fundamental self there that you can delight in and still like many, many years later. But I like older people. I find them interesting.
And the other thing that was really strong in this book for me was the physicality of it, the sense of place, the location, the elements, the weather. So how important for you is that sense of a place?
Well, that's one thing that takes shape pretty early on, usually, when I'm writing. I like to know pretty clearly where my characters are, because that determines a whole lot of things. It determines how people behave. Place is incredibly important to me. And I also left a place that I'd lived in for about 30 years out on Up Banks Peninsula, a very tiny little bay called Otanarito, which means the growing point of a man, because there's a very big phallic rock stack at the front of the head of the bay. It's one of those pointers when you're sailing up and down the coast. That's how the old waka found their way in there. And so it's a very beautiful, very isolated place. It's an hour and a half from Christchurch and half an hour out of Akaroa. And I lived there for a very long time, but in 2017 we left for various reasons, but partly because, it was time to head out, because if you live in the country you have to make sure the water runs and it's over to you to do that, and if there are any repairs to be made they have to be done by yourself. And we felt that we needed a slightly gentler life as we were heading towards 70. So we left. But it's a very much a part of me, and I love being able to go back into the bay in this book and just remember things like the fog pouring in over the hillsides. The fog up there would come in as a big wall up the bay, and there's just us there and a farmer up the road a bit, and then the rest of it's a big botanical reserve, thousands of acres of botanical reserve. So the fog would come and pour down the hillsides like a sort of waterfall, and there'd be this sense of the sea always. You're always aware of the mood of the sea. I just loved revisiting it and putting people there who were also aware of how beautiful it is. It's a very precious place, actually.
Mm. Yes, and that shone through in the book.
How good.
Very much so. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Fiona, for coming on the show today and talking about The Deck. Like I said, a book that I loved and found unexpected felicity in.
That's from Boccaccio. That's one of the topics.
And really enjoyed. So, thank you for talking about the book, and all the best for your future endeavours.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you. It's been lovely talking.
We're going to take a short music break, and we'll be back soon. Da 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 bum bum da 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 bum bum da 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 bum bum da 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 da
faith in you. I'll stick with you, kid, that's the bottom line. Yeah, you have a lot of fun, don't you? And living with you is a ball of a time. Hey, beauty, when the mood gets you down, you bottom lips fear dragging on the ground. That's when I gotta play the clown for you. Black humor made you kick your boots. Howdy, angel. Where did you hide your wings?
To be when you grow up. They say you are what you read, and the university bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Welcome back. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Vanda Simon, which is the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and sponsored by that great team at the University Bookshop. And speaking of the University Bookshop, we'll just put a little notice in here that next week on Thursday, the 20th of July, they're going to be holding their annual Winter Warmer Night from 5:30 onwards and open till quite late. And not only do you get the opportunity for a 15% discount, there's often some quite nice nice treats there as well. So do keep an eye out for that. Well, next I'm going to turn the tables on myself. Usually I'm the one doing the interviews, but today I've actually invited Beverly Martins into the studio. Now, Beverly is a writer of poetry, plays and short stories and has a background in business and media writing. And she was also for many years the host of the Dunedin Literary Walk. So she's your go-to on any local literary sites and stories. So Beverly, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vanda, and great to be here. And as you say, about to turn the tables.
Away you go.
So, firstly, congratulations. How fantastic that you've written the fifth in the Sam Shepard series, Detective Sam Shepard, I should say. Expectant. It's been a while between drinks, though, hasn't it? Or should I say cups of Milo?
Yes.
And chocolate biscuits. Because it's been something like 12 years since the fourth in the series, and this is the fifth. So I know what you've been up to, but could you just give the listeners a wee quick snapshot of what's been happening in that time professionally for you?
Yes, well, way back in 2011 it would have been when Bound was published, I was looking at other endeavours as well. After Bound, I published in 2012 Faceless, which was a standalone novel, which my publishers asked me to do something a bit different, which I did then. But after that, I embarked on a little study journey. So this is one of the dangers of writing crime fiction, is that you have to do research. And as part of the research, I did one of the Otago Summer School forensic biology course, because I thought, for crime fiction, it'd be good to learn something about the forensics. And so I did the summer school course and I enjoyed it so much. I thought, I'd forgotten how much I just really enjoy studying. Also, Jules Keyser, the late Jules Keyser, who was the lecturer and coordinator at the time, he kept saying to me, Vanda, you should come and do some more study. Vanda, you should come and do some postgraduate work. Because my original degree back in the day was in pharmacy, so I had a pharmacy degree, and he's quite persuasive actually. So I did a small postgraduate certificate in pharmacy research, and then sort of thought, well, let's step this up, and I did a PhD looking at the communication of science and crime fiction. So it satisfied a couple of elements of my inner nerd, and it also in my science nerd, and it also satisfied my my crime writer side of things.
Because it had a Naya Marsh focused, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So Naya Marsh, who is New Zealand's probably most famous and most productive and world known crime writer, she was born in Christchurch and she wrote 32 crime fiction novels, the Roderick Allen series. And I'd always really admired her writing, and I wanted to use her kind of like a case study in how she approached the science in her novels and her research and everything like that. So that was part of my study. And the other thing I did in the study was I surveyed readers of crime fiction to see if they believed the science they read in crime fiction, or if they even cared that it was real and truth. And I also surveyed writers of crime fiction about, again, whether they felt obliged to provide true and accurate representations of the science in their fiction, and amongst other things. So it was a fascinating thing, but I could not for the life of me combine both creative writing and academic writing, so the fiction novels had to go on hold for a wee bit.
Brilliant. Mm. Excellent. So now that you're back at your desk doing that, what sort of changes in the world in general and policing in particular did you sort of have to factor in researching this particular book?
Technology had changed so much. So in the first Sam Shepard series, back in the day, smartphones weren't a thing. People had cell phones, as it were, but you didn't have this like little pocket tracking device computer that we all carry around with us at all times. So I had to rethink that. Also, interestingly, I got a British publisher, and my British publisher asked me to revise and re-edit the older novels. And so when I was doing that process, I had the opportunity to upgrade some of that technology in the older novels.
And make them that it flowed better into the current one.
And made them a little more timeless.
Yes.
And that process gave me the awareness in writing from now on of not dating myself in the novels too much with the specifics of technology. So it's made me a little bit more aware that you have to be a bit careful that you don't...
sort of lock yourself into one time period.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to think about, you know, the fact that your protagonist can be pretty much tracked at all times. So, you know, how can you make that not happen? And also advances in medical technology. So an expectant, I had this idea for expectant right back when I had finished Bound. But I had to review some of that because the medical technology that I had in my mind then had advanced so much further in the modern day that I had to sort of do a wee retake and a rethink around
about
how to
work it in. Mm. So why don't you give the listeners just a quick update on Sam Shepard, where she's at in her life now. Mm. I don't think there's too
no
much
spoilers,
of a spoiler.
No.
The clue's in the title, folks, but yeah. I'll leave it over to you, Vanda.
So, well, an expectant Sam Shepard is literally like 2 weeks off going on maternity leave as she's very heavily pregnant, and the challenges of working, of course, that comes with that. So her duties are pretty much down to being in a desk job, and she's having to get her head around the fact herself that, hello, she's going to be a mother very, very soon. And an expectant, the case, there's a horrific murder in Dunedin that really, really rocks everyone, and most certainly Sam and Paul, her partner, because the woman who's murdered was extremely pregnant. So she can just relate to this case. It becomes very, very personal for her, and she's also aware that she wants to find satisfaction with this case and solve it before she is herself going to be embarking on a new adventure in life.
I think that's one of the key sort of signature pieces of your styles of your writing, if you like, Vanda, which is that contrast. Though the crime is grim. It's
yeah.
You know, it's. I mean, I don't think you make it overly graphic. It's just the nature of the crime is pretty blimmin' horrendous. But you always manage to contrast that with the sort of normality of daily life. You know, there's always the sort of yeah-nah banter that goes on between the main characters, you know, Paul and Sam and her bestie Maggie. You know, that's a really interesting contrast. Is that sort of deliberate for you?
Absolutely, because in part of the character development of Sam is that I wanted her to be an optimistic soul. And I think that optimism shines through. Back when I first wrote about Sam, you know, a lot of the tropes in fiction at the time were these damaged detectives, most predominantly male,
men
divorced,
alone, drinking
alcoholic,
problem,
punch off a jazz.
Yes.
Yeah. And I railed against that. I was like, no, I want someone who is young and optimistic and actually has faith in human nature, to her detriment sometimes, because, you know, she can be too trusting. So for me, that underlying humour and humanity was really, really important.
Yeah, and I think that's what struck me too, is that against this backdrop, there's actually a lot of araha in the book, isn't there?
Yes.
And that's something that you obviously wanted to hang on to.
Absolutely. And people, you know, people do things for different reasons, and I really wanted to show that life is not black and white. You know, yeah. It's a very interesting shades of grey, and I wanted people to be able to relate to the whys these things may happen, and think, you know, potentially there, but for the grace of God.
And how far you might go to protect your child.
Yeah.
And where is that line? And you know,
because, you know, black and white is not the reality of life.
No, absolutely not. I did notice, and I'm not sure if there's more than, there's a lot of swearing in this book, though. Is that sort of Sam's sort of rage and frustrations? I mean, she's a what you see is what you get character.
Yeah.
She's, you know, as you say, she's very kind, but she can flare up pretty quickly too and push back on things. And that's, I suppose, I wanted you to talk about sort of policing and how you fit that character into that world, because obviously on the downside, there's a lot of misogyny still. And on the upside, there's much more cultural sensitivity that she's quite tuned into. And some of her colleagues aren't. So just talk about that.
Well, the swearing thing is so funny. So Sam's a farm girl and she's got brothers. So, you know, she always came from an environment that was fairly coarse. But that's just how she expresses herself in a way and stops from bottling things up. But hilariously, I have never, ever, ever had a complaint from a reader about the grisly murders or anything like that, but I have had complaints about the swearing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, my mother used to tell me off about the amount of swearing in my books, which I thought was just hilarious.
Well, Sam's mother tells her off about just about everything too.
True.
Yeah. And obviously you've always had to, and this is another strong theme in the book, is the kind of working mother thing, isn't there?
Yes.
It's like, I love my job and it's really absorbing and I want to do that well. Sam's right on the precipice of working out how to juggle that with, a newborn, and she doesn't quite know, and, you know, all of that's coming into it. You've always had to juggle your writing with, you know, raising your two boys. I know that they're young adults now, but still. How's that kind of thing, especially with juggling with, I know you work full-time now, you're in the second kind of year of being the national president of Society of Authors, so have you got more on your plate these days than you did when you started writing, or have you always just had a lot on your plate?
I've always had a lot on my plate, and it's just different plates.
Yeah.
We could go into food analogies here, but and you adapt as you go. When I had the boys at home, you know, when I very first started writing, they were 6 months old and two Wow. years old. So writing was very much just catching snippets of time, you know, 10, 20 minutes here. I still managed to write a novel. It took a long time, but it was doable. But then as they progressed into going to school, and it sort of freed up other amounts of time, and I had more time for writing, but then the need to go back into the workforce, and then, like I said, doing my research stuff, compressed the time for writing again. So it goes in phases in life, and nothing's ever constant in that way. So present, you know, I'm having to revert back to the clutches of 10, 20 minutes again.
I was going to ask you that. Is it a little
like
and
the
often?
Boys.
Little and often. Yeah.
You know, been a few phases in life where I was pretty much able to do it full time, and, you know, I was able to do a novel a year easily at that stage. But now, again, it's a lot more complex. So I've just kind of learned in that writing process to be kind on myself and trust that I'll get it done.
And that you can get to it more quickly, if you know what I mean. Like if you've got the writing time, that you don't second guess yourself.
Yeah.
You don't muck around.
My craft has improved over the years. Now, with each novel, you know where the bar is set. One of the advantages of doing a series is that I'm not having to develop characters from the outset. You know, I've got a core base of characters. You know, I'm developing the new people who are involved in that particular case. So it's not as mentally arduous.
You're not world building in the same way that
you
would if you were doing, you know, some kind of fantasy series set on a different planet every time.
Yeah, and I'm kind of, so when I do my first draft is actually a pretty well formed, crafted first draft, and so once that's done, then it's the editing process is relatively quick for me.
Right.
That's just and that's the way I do it. Other people, every writer's different in the way they manage things, because everyone's circumstances are different, everyone's style of writing, of learning, of imagining is different.
You know, we talked about the swearing, but I want to talk about the other things that always come up in your books, which is the food.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I think, you know, Dunedin restaurants and cafes must love you, because you name check quite a few of them. I'm pretty sure, I mean, not that you would take advantage, but you could get free coffee and cake anywhere in town.
I've never had it, alas.
Is the food thing a you thing or a Sam thing?
It's both, really. One of the things I love about reading is a sense of place, and I think it's actually really important for readers to be able to relate, and I love that Dunedin readers can sit there in a cafe and go, Sam Shepherd had this, she had the cheese scone, she thought it was good too. In fact, I have known of a few readers who have taken a food tour for the books and gone to each cafe.
That. Yes, and had what you know, the cinnamon scroll here and the...
Seen what's on
and
the menu. So,
it's
a fun way of promoting the city, but also it's a fun way of making your character feel relatable and accessible, because, you know, I love my food, let's be honest, and particularly particularly in this novel, because you know, Sam's very pregnant.
I thought they gave you a lot more license. Yeah. Any cravings or anything you could indulge.
She's like a Labrador.
In. Yeah. Strange ice cream flavours. Yes. But, I did wonder about that, that you had much more sort of carte blanche, if you pardon the food pun there.
And it just adds little details like that, I think, add texture and depth to someone in little subtle ways.
Yeah. I think you're right, and that's what is lovely is that kind of light dark thing is, you know, sometimes you're just sitting on the couch but
eating toffee pots and drinking Milo,
you know, having, you know, both being in the police, obviously there's, you know, and such a, you know, such a horrific case is never far from anyone's mind anyway, so it's that opportunity to sort of subtly move the plot along, I would think. Yeah. Brilliant. Great.
And it's fun.
Yeah.
And it means I have to do research in cafes around Dunedin. Tragic.
Yeah, very tragic. Right. So can we talk about what's next for you? Or do you know what's next in terms of your writing projects? Or?
Yes. So I'm going to be writing another Sam Shepard novel next.
Fantastic.
While I've got some momentum. And because I feel particularly for our New Zealand readers, it's been such a long break between drinks that, I want to have Sam come along again. And in this next Sam novel, you know, this is her first maternity. Coming back from maternity leave. So, you know, brilliant. She's going to be coming back quite new and...
But
just that
juggling,
whole juggling
obviously.
Of you know, first time juggling parenthood and work and life balance, as well as, you know, a gritty case to get her head around. But I also will be doing a follow up to The Faceless at some point because I loved Max as a character then.
Book.
And
yeah.
I've had so many readers sort of say, ask me, you know, are you going to do another novel about Max? Because, you know, he's such a great character.
And that was such a, Faceless was such a contrast, wasn't it? Because it was, you know, in a much bigger city and sort of homelessness and, you know, just some other things that were going on. And there, that's quite different from the, you know, the Dunedin thing is quite, you know, a few city blocks really in lots of ways, isn't it? Because the police station's downtown and, you know, that's kind of where most of the action is. And, I mean, we're never far from anywhere in Dunedin anyway, so.
And The Faceless was also a chance to explore, you know, the Sam Shepard novels, they're all from within Sam's head. No, it's first person. It's straight out of her mouth. Whereas the Faceless and the follow up that's from a number of different people's perspectives, which from me from a writing perspective is quite refreshing and something different to do and a nice challenge.
Brilliant. That's really great. So, where can we get Faceless? Where is it? And talk about your international thing with Arenda Books. I'm
yes,
really interested
so,
in that too.
My British publisher is called Arenda Books, which is a lovely little independent bookseller, book publisher, Karen Sullivan. And she is fabulous and she's really, really likes books that have a sense of place. So she publishes a lot of like Scandinavian fiction and she chooses books because of that. And so she's my publisher, but in New Zealand it's available in actually all the main bookstores now. University Bookshop has it and you know, Paper Plus and the likes, and your independent bookseller. So, and if they don't have it, you can ask and get it ordered. It's also available as an e-book, an audio book, and large print, oddly enough.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, because that's kind of an inverse relationship to a lot of writers. You know, they try and get the New Zealand thing happening and then they're desperate for international. You've kind of, this has been
done it the other way, which has its own challenges when it comes to getting the books into the country, but it's all worked very well.
Excellent. Well, I think that's probably just about it from me.
And then very nice from my perspective being interviewed.
I mean, you know, you've been on the other side of the desk for 15 years, Vanda, so it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you and, you know, promote one of your books for a change. Is there anything else you want to kind of add about Expected?
No, other than I'm just so delighted to have Sam back out there and to get such lovely feedback because I was... You lose your confidence when you have such a big gap.
Getting back on the horse thing.
Yeah, it was quite terrifying having a new work out there. But the feedback has all been fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to writing the next Sam Shepard novel.
Given that you work full-time still, though, and those other commitments I was talking about. Do you have time frames, or are they being imposed by publishers? Because
The next one will be out towards the end of next year.
Oh,
mid to end of next year.
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah, excellent. All right, well, we look forward to that. And just to recap, the novel is Expectant by Vanda Simon. It's the number 5 in the Sam Shepard series, and it's almost a reboot, isn't it?
Yes.
I think, because there's more books in the series to come. Great. Thank you so much, Vanda.
Thank you, Beverly. And oh, that was so lovely being interviewed. Thank you so much. And that is actually our show for this month. So thank you for listening in. And thank you to my guest, Fiona Farrell, who was talking about her most recent novel, The Deck. And also, of course, to Beverly for talking to me today about my novel, Expectant. So thank you for listening in. And join us again next month for another hour delving into that wonderful world of books. But until then, enjoy lots of happy reading.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.